This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
6 months now since Nancy Guthrie was taken from her Tucson home, and the biggest break in the public's understanding of this case did not come from a press conference. It came from a mistake. Maybe this shouldn't be a surprise. The sheriff's office put out a media release with the ransom Bitcoin address attached, address printed right on it, and my guest traced every transaction on that wallet. Jennifer Coffendaffer is with us, retired FBI special agent, joining me to discuss what she found. So, the Pima County Sheriff's Office sent out its own media release with the alleged kidnapper's Bitcoin wallet address at the bottom. They pulled it back, but it was already screenshotted out there on the internets. That address is the only reason the public knows what the money actually did. I want to talk about what was in it, but I also want to talk about how. How does the office that's running this case leak that? I mean, there's nobody's checking work here anymore, are they? There's no proofers, there's no editors, there's no, hey, let's just get a second set of eyes on this before we post it. It just seems to be like, click, done, oops. is that really pretty much what we're talking about here?
It kind of seems like, right, it's just a tweet or something. Like, yeah, I'm throwing this out, here's a couple thoughts here. you know, it's really unfortunate, in a sense, that happened. I mean, for all of us that followed this case, it was, for me at least, a huge epiphany. I was able to really understand the transactions, the note, the links, which were really important. And so it really shed a lot of light on the case. On the case, for sure.
Yeah, it's almost like it has the importance of the local school district tweeting out the lunch menu of that week. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just baffling the amount of thought that goes into just like when we put something out, when you tweet something out. I mean, you proof it a little bit. You make like, okay, does this make sense? Is this, you know, it's not just, oh, shoot, I shouldn't have put that out there. But they did, and it is out there now, so it is what it is. Your trace showed the FBI moved 0.0022 Bitcoin, roughly $300 at the time, into that wallet on February 10th, and it's still sitting there untouched today, from what I can understand. No ransom was ever paid, not $4 million, not a dime. So when Savannah Guthrie has come out and said, we did our part, what part is she exactly talking about?
Well, I tell you what, Tony, with that small amount of Bitcoin that went in, and I'm not sure exactly why they chose that amount, but I don't think it was tickling the wire, obviously. The whole idea of tickling the wire means you tickle and you get a reaction. That amount of money would do nothing to get a reaction, but it did make it obvious that you could do deposits into that account. It assured that, but this is the big thing it did. It allowed a message to be attached to that deposit. And that message had a secret link that once it was opened, I believe by the bad guys, it blew up, gone, disintegrated into the ether. So in other words, that opened up a line of communication between the Guthries and the abductors. And we can't see what happened from that point on. So it's possible that Savannah did make the deposit like she alludes to in her message.
So there is a link. Is that link, because I was getting somewhat educated in this as I was learning about it. I didn't know you could send messages and things like that through the wallets. This is very valuable to us and we will pay. That's the message that was there. Is that the area? Is that where there was a link included with that message? Help me understand.
Yes, this is very valuable to us and we will pay. And then there's a link that they could press that took them into a whole nother communication system. But the minute it's opened, it blows up. In other words, no one else can open that link ever again. Now that can be put on a timer, like 6 months, 2 weeks, whatever. But I don't think the Bureau would have put that on a timer. They would want to keep communication open. So if that is correct, then the bad guys would have had to have opened that link, or TMZ, or, you know, the media outlets, which I don't think they would be that stupid to do that. And So I think that at least they opened it. So it begs the question, was there interactions between them after that? And was another Bitcoin address provided where Savannah could have made a deposit like she alludes to in her message?
Like the, where she's verbally said, we've done our part. Maybe there was, maybe it goes beyond this wallet is what you're saying, that it would have went somewhere. I'm assuming that link, I'm going to guess, would be, you know, traceable to an IP. Whoever clicks on it, that's an IP connecting there. Could be through a VPN, could lead absolutely nowhere to someone who is clicking on it to protect themselves. I mean, it's another line out there, I guess, that could lead somewhere, but it, like I said, it may lead absolutely nowhere. Do we know anything about that link? If it was clicked, who clicked it, where it would have gone, what it would have done? Does it go to another Bitcoin? Does it lead to, what does it lead to? Does it lead to like the line of communication, or do we have any idea other than it's a string of numbers and letters that lead somewhere, and that's about all we know?
Well, we know it leads to communication. So we know that they could send messages. They could have left another Bitcoin address. It opened up that communication, which is great. To me, it was very interesting knowing that it was opened, in my opinion. It was opened because it disintegrated. In other words, if it wouldn't have been open, that link would still be able to go into, but you can't. Because when you do, it gives a 404 message that basically says it's gone.
Do we know about the timeline here on how this all went down? Because you get the first ransom demand letter, then you obviously get the second that says she's dead and we're sorry. Where does this message on there of we're serious about this, we will pay, the link, and then the second letter that comes out saying we're sorry, she's dead? How does this all fall on the timeline?
Well, unfortunately, it falls when it's too late. It falls on 2/10. February 10th is when it all happens. And I find that very interesting because, of course, that is when the Porch Guy video and photos were released. So to me, this is when the Bureau is really taking this case by the horns. Obviously, they were invited in on the fourth day or so, but you got to get ramped up. You got to get everything opened. You know, people think that it's kind of just like that. But it's really not. There's a lot to do. You got to make assignments. You got to pull people off of other cases. You got to get money. All of this takes time. So I find it interesting. Everything, bam, happened on the 10th.
Is there a possibility here that Savannah did pay millions of dollars, the $4 million or whatever it was, through a different account here, doing her part, and has not received anything back, not even information about where her mother may be buried?
Well, I think it's possible, and it would have been going against what the FBI would have recommended, but it happens all the time. The fallacy is that people think because the FBI recommends something that everybody follows the FBI's recommendations. And also, this happens worldwide. People are taken. We talked about the numbers for Bitcoin in wrenched style attacks, 800 plus million last year that was paid. And I've pointed out very specific cases where relatives were taken. They sent out what they wanted. The relative who was rich paid it, and they actually got the person back. They told them where they were so authorities could go get them. So I'm not saying that that's 100% what happened here. I'm just saying that happens. And to me, it really makes that last letter, the apology letter, make a lot more sense, doesn't it, Tony? Like, oh God, you sent me that money. I'm sorry it didn't work out.
But the fact that they never revealed where the body was, that makes me believe even more that these ransom letters have nothing to do with Nancy, that it was somebody going for an advantageous, let's try and get some millions of dollars out of Savannah and be on our little merry way. Because if that's what happened, a big if, we don't know if that's what happened, but if we're conjecturing this up, if they didn't say where the body is and she paid, Does that make you believe more that these are from a legitimate source that had anything to do with the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie, or someone who bamboozled the FBI, bamboozled the Guthries into giving them several million dollars on an empty promise?
Well, so obviously a lot of people agree with you that this was just a farce to get money. But I want to reiterate why I don't believe that. Number one, they said exactly where her white watch was, exactly where it was. Not it's on the nightstand where one might guess it could be. They had that information within, you know, 24 hours. That note went out the second. Remember, she was taken on the first. So I should say within a day, right? It came out the second. So how could they possibly know her white, very specific, and I haven't seen pictures of her with the white watch, mm-hmm. was at the end of the bed. How could they know exactly about the floodlight? My belief is they did both of these things. It wasn't that her watch fell. They put it there so they could say, the watch is here. We broke the white floodlight. Remember, this is no light is allowed. So it's not like her floodlights were on. It's not mm-hmm. allowed to be on. You can have a porch light on, but they would have smashed that, Tony. So that's why the Bureau. Plus, why would the Bureau? It would be totally sadistic to make this family do the first plea, the second. There's been seven pleas now fed in terms of what they were going to say by the BAU. Why mm-hmm. would they pull all those resources if they don't believe these two notes are real? And why, when Reuters came out and said they were trash, why would have the Bureau, or one of a handful of times in this whole 6 months, come out and say, kidnap for ransom, and we're looking into the notes? I think they were pissed.
Let me ask you about the evidence, the Apple Watch on the ground and the destroyed floodlight, because I believe that was the word used, destroyed floodlight. I have two thoughts on it. First, I'm wondering if someone within the investigation could have had a conversation openly somewhere at the subway, at the Arby's, wherever you're chatting, somebody overhears this, or somebody that they knew overhears this, and they go, there's some inside information nobody else knows. And if they are so advantageous and creative and evil and want to try and pull something like that off, there's some information that nobody else would know outside of inside the investigation. That would be interesting. I would be looking at anybody within that ether that suddenly has a windfall of money that may have landed on them in the last handful of months. Highly doubtful that's that. But it's an angle. The other angle on that would be that maybe they did, in fact, know these facts. Let me ask you about the floodlight, though. We were talking about this the other day. Was the floodlight destroyed? We know it wasn't working, but burned out, not working, whatever. Very different than destroyed. Do we know what the actual condition of the floodlight was?
Well, I tell you, you can look at Google Maps and try to find all this information. And that's what everybody said. Oh, somebody saw it on Google Maps. Please show me.
Yeah.
Because I've been looking. I can't see it. And further, just to key off of that, many people, including me, I've used that in other cases. I'll give you an example, is Melody Buzzard. When everybody was saying, oh, that little girl in the wig, who's much taller, who doesn't look anything like the photos we had seen, mm-hmm. that wasn't Melody with the mom at the rental office, for those of you who followed that case.
Yeah.
Well, I got really lucky, went on Google Maps, because I like to do that, and I looked and I saw her coming out of the house with mama in that exact same stature. And so I said, see, she was tall and big. It's nothing like these photos of her, which we kind of knew were aged photos, but
yeah.
It's great to see that. So what I'm saying is Google Maps is such a great tool, and I can't find that floodlight on Google Maps. I don't think it exists. I think they crushed it. I think they destroyed it as a marker. I really think so, for them to be believed.
Yeah, we just don't know the other side to that yet. That's the thing. I mean, and I get people saying the Google Maps thing, but what gets me is the verbiage destroyed. And I mean, to destroy a floodlight, it takes a little. I mean, why do you do? I guess what were they going to destroy a floodlight with? I mean, you're going to need some sort of apparatus to reach that high and then hit it hard enough to actually destroy it. That would cause some noise. That would cause some kerfuffle. I would think that'd be more than someone would actually want to be doing if they're trying to break into a home and not be noticed. That's what gets me about that is what is stating that is one thing. It actually being what reality is on the outside of Nancy Guthrie's house, we still don't know the answer to it. The investigators would know. Anybody close enough to the house would probably know that answer. I'm curious about that one. I don't know that we truly have an answer yet.
Well, first of all, Tony, just that you put kerfuffle into a sentence, I'm just like blown away right now. Kerfuffle. Okay. But moving on from kerfuffle, I picture the floodlight as being on the ground and going up.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I always think of them. Yeah, that could be too. You're right. Yeah.
I could be wrong, but that's how I picture it. And I literally picture taking a foot and just, you know, bashing it and dismantling it from the electrical wires and so forth. So that's that. But again, I look at the reaction of the FBI. And the reaction of the FBI was clearly they believed these notes and they orchestrated the response to the notes. And I mean, I heard Savannah say with her own mouth on NBC to Hoda, she believes those first two notes are real.
Yeah.
And now that I've finally been able to see them and we've finally been able to see them, they make a lot of sense in terms of the demand. That really makes sense, although written oddly. And then the second one,
Having now seen the Bitcoin wallet and what was in it, from an investigative standpoint, what would you have done differently in terms of how that whole thing played out? What went in, what went out, the notes that were sent through it? Or did they do everything as they thought would be the most advantageous to get information or to get Nancy back? Did they do anything wrong?
I have one picadillo. Mm-hmm. Kerfuffles and picadillos today.
Yeah.
My issue is with all the SMEs, the subject matter experts working on this case and companies involved that I 100% know exist, private companies that can help with this digital trail and following it. When they put that link in, it had to be airtight for tracing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just believe it must not have been. In other words, it must not have been airtight that the people use whatever we talked about, a VPN, ton address.
There's only so tight you can make that link. I mean, you're dependent on what's coming to it. And if what's coming to it is already masked through a VPN, there's nothing about that link or that's going to like take that mask off. So you're kind of at the mercy of them going at it with something that is revealing. And if they're in any way competent in what they're doing, one would think that they would have masked that. But again, I mean, that also does speak to the sophistication of whoever is doing this. If this was a fly-by-night jewel thief who hit the wrong house, which is kind of where I've been going for a while, I don't know that they're going to be that well-versed in Bitcoin wallets and VPNs and all that. I don't know. I mean, it's a more complex criminal organization might be. But all it takes is one person with a bit of knowledge. These are really not that super complex of concepts to wrap your mind around. You could spend an hour and learn it by watching some YouTube videos. But I guess the question is, you know, did the person take that time to do that or have that sort of knowledge, considering they were grabbing, you know, cilantro to cover the camera to begin with? It doesn't strike me as the most sophisticated of operations.
Well, riddle me this, Tony, just as a thought.
Yeah.
We see a lot that shows sophistication.
Sure.
We just do, you know, even setting up this Bitcoin account not to be traced.
Yeah.
And there's a whole system within Bitcoin that you have to, just like if you open a bank account, you have to give them your, you know, your mother's last name, right?
Yeah.
I'm joking, but you have to give all your identifiers. They were able to do this surreptitiously. Mm-hmm. So when you think about that, when you think about the fact that the emails weren't traced, when you think about the fact that they knew to use these tip lines that would make them almost unable to be found, at least so far, when you think about the link that was utilized, but not able to be traced, a lot of these details, right? It does seem that there's some sophistication. So if it's this, if you have a more sophisticated network here,
yeah,
who identified Nancy as an amazing target,
yeah,
because of the relationship with Savannah and the huge amount of money Savannah had, and then you have a mope that we see on the front porch, you know, and you task that mope also with sending these letters. That's why you see two completely opposite formatted letters, right? The first letter, mope, this is what we want you to send out.
Yeah.
It screws up. He forgets the dollar sign. He spells words wrong. He kind of makes a few errors, but he basically does what he's told to do. And the second note, and we know they're the same person because they have the same Bitcoin address or the same
IP. Yeah.
And then the second note isn't him being guided by any sophisticated people, but him doing it because he's worried about his tail. He's the one on the line if he gets caught. Just a thought there.
Yeah.
It could be such big difference. In the
Don't necessarily have to be the same person for it to be true, essentially. Which is so much of this. It's like, are these even the same things that are connected? Are they not? Are they the same person? There's so many things. One more thing I want to get your take on. Nanos, another, you know, fine statement over the week, saying there may be thousands of hours of video that still hasn't been reviewed. Now, we're 6 months in. WTF is he talking about?
I'll tell you what he's talking about. Yeah. And we've touched on it some, but I might not have been as specific as I meant to be. Nancy's house here.
Yeah.
Points of exit here, right? You have to go right or left. And then choke points that veer off in all these different directions and continue choke pointing, meaning you get to the street and you have to turn right, you have to turn left, you have to go straight, whatever the case may be. Investigators have to follow each exit route and the tributaries from those routes and get all the video they can, until hopefully it actually goes to a main thoroughfare where traffic cams could catch them. The good news is, right, it's such a finite time frame, right? 228, it disconnected. So they're not looking like 24 hours. But those tributaries have all these cameras. I think that's exactly what they're talking about. I think analysts with the FBI are sitting at their desks literally looking at these different footages hours and hours a day.
There's only so many out, you know, places you're going to go. We're not talking like millions of roads here. We're talking, tens, maybe, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's not an egregious amount.
I'm going to say hundreds.
And we're talking six months since this happened. Mm-hmm. What the fuck have they been doing? If they haven't looked at this video, isn't that like the first thing you look at? I mean, why 6 months? There's thousands of hours, Nanos. What is everybody out on vacation at Arby's? Or like, what's going on?
Well, I think the only ones looking at it, first of all, aren't special agents. That was something that I seldom, if ever, did. Only when it came to child porn cases did we handle all of that, looking at videos. But when it comes to that, that's going to go to the IAs. And first of all, Nanos doesn't have that kind of staff, period. So that's going to be the FBI staff working on it. Remember, they did the same in Koberger.
Yeah.
And finally identified a car. Remember how?
It was like within 6 weeks. We're at 6 months. That's what I just don't get here is the timeline.
That's true. But the difference is on Koberger's case, that place was lit up like a Christmas tree everywhere. This whole dark situation has such a huge impact on these cameras being able to catch a plate or catch a car. And then once you think you have one, then you're sending it up to headquarters to get it, you know, fine tuned. I just wonder if they literally cannot fine tune any of the images they have and they're still searching.
I understand, like, fine tuning. I mean, be great, but 6 months in, I mean, something. Can we put something out there? If you got a video of something, some semblance of a vehicle, Koberger's car wasn't that clear either, and it was put out there. I don't know. I either it's in streaming competence or they have nothing. It feels like one of the two. I don't know. Just 6 months in, saying there's still thousands of hours to go through here. Huh? What do you mean? Yeah, like you haven't done it yet? I don't know.
I don't think they've done it. And the other thing is, even though you might have, we have thousands of IAs, you know, investigative assistants in the Bureau that are looking through these, but they also have hundreds of other cases on there. And at some point you get, it's already been streamed down way. Yeah. I mean, there's a handful of people working on this, let's be honest,
Tony. Yeah, I feel like between you and me, we could have put together a ragtag band of true crimers to go through the video and had answers within the weekend in February, and we're in August now. I don't know. The excuses, the statements, they just don't add up. But it's Nano, so par for the course. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. Alec Murdaugh. Let's talk about old Alec. His case just moved twice in 2 days. A federal judge has now thrown out Murdaugh's $600,000 lawsuit against Becky Hill, the former clerk whose jury interference got his murder convictions overturned. The next day, his lawyers have filed a motion demanding prosecutors dig back through every file and every agency for anything that could help him before the April retrial through a Brady Giglio motion. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, is here with us to discuss. Let's talk about the lawsuit getting thrown out. First of all, I found it kind of interesting. $600,000 was at play. It was really never about the money. That was the vehicle to get the lawsuit going. But when studying the argument, you can hate Alec Murdaugh and he can still make valid arguments. $600,000, he says he spent out of his retirement accounts to pay his attorneys. And then because Becky Hill screwed up the trial, now he has to do this all over again. So because she screwed it up, that tainted the pool. All that money I spent, even though he lost, well, he's outed. He's already paid it. He should get that paid back since he has to go back and do this all over again. The court said, nope, she wasn't the true cause, the injury, if you will, to this, and you don't get that money back. I don't know. I kind of agree with Alec on that one. She tainted the pool. She should probably pay, but the judge did keep the door open and said, you know, after the next trial, you might still be able to bring this one back, and you still might be able to try and get Becky a bill. What are your thoughts? Was this the right call to toss it out on the grounds that they did?
Well, first of all, Alec Murdaugh, it's nauseating to me. No matter what, he has to go to trial, right? Yeah. That first trial is happening with or without Becky Hill. Yeah. So he was going to go to trial no matter what. So the preposterous notion that Becky Hill has to pay for his trial that he would have had to do no matter what is just that preposterous. Okay, so just on the face there. Becky Hill screws the pooch in the first trial, which is also nauseating that she stuck her nose and her mouth and idiotically decided to jabber badly about Alec Murdaugh, ruining that conviction. And now he has to do it again. He should be doing jumping jacks and whistling Dixie that she screwed up.
He's probably whistling Dixie. He does seem like someone who might whistle Dixie from behind bars. Like, what's that sound? It's this Alec. He's whistling Dixie again. Can you tell him to shut up? It's 10 o'clock at night. I'm trying to get sleep. I could see that being a problem. Alex doing Dixie. Yeah, I mean, put it this way. I mean, it's funny to argue this, but if you're having a pool party and Becky Hill decides to show up and pour toxic acid into the pool, and you have to cancel. The pool party gets canceled. You got to drain the pool. You got to bring everybody back. The caterer has to come back. Everything has to be rehired. You got to pay for it all again. She's the one who screwed it up. I think she's liable for that.
Well, no matter what, you would have paid for your pool party.
You would. But you got a case against the person that destroyed it, too, on purpose.
Well, that's the thing. She didn't do it on purpose.
Or does she just have to? She didn't do it on purpose.
Her words were on purpose.
Yes.
I don't think she had any idea the impact that it would have. I really don't.
Because she's an idiot. You can't fix that part.
You can't fix that part. I was wondering how many other times she decided to, you know, songbird.
So do I. I think every single case that's ever been near this woman, it should be reviewed for whatever she decided to be a songbird at. But it is an interesting argument. But the argument is, well, she can pay for your second one, maybe. If they want to bring a second suit off of this after the second trial. So she's obviously not in prison, but she's also not now having to pay $600,000. The big point of the whole thing, though, was to get into discovery to get people in for depositions in ways that they didn't necessarily have the levers of doing through the criminal process. That's why the civil area existed. It's also why they filed the Brady Giglio motion. What do you think, how does this hurt the defense of Alec Murdaugh, if at all? Or was this a long shot to begin with when Poot and Dick decided to file this thing a couple of months ago?
Well, I want to touch base on something you said about filing the lawsuit, 100% that is why they did it, just so they could get more information. And when it comes to Becky Hill, she's a turnip. You can't get blood from a turnip, even if it was $600,000 and the judge would have said, she would have just been like, okay, I'm going to file bankruptcy. I can't pay this. I can never pay this. She doesn't have that kind of money. She's in lots of trouble money-wise, I think anyway, with everything she had to put out to defend herself. And obviously her book didn't make a dime because it was yanked from the shelf. So all of that aside, we know that this was for this purpose. As far as did it help them, you know, it couldn't hurt them. I mean, anytime you can get more information on a case, it's good. And anytime you can get people to discuss something multiple times, it's good because they always add, change, just accidentally. Everybody's first statement is always the one to go with. After that, it always gets corrupted, especially years down the line.
Wouldn't it be interesting if Becky did a new book? I would read that one, like about all of this, about the aftermath, about mucking up Murdaugh. There's the title, Mucking Up Murdaugh, with a foreword by Alec singing Dixie. That'd be part of the audiobook. Alec sings Dixie over the phone from prison.
Hey, I got a song I want to sing, everybody.
You know, I think it'd be great. I would get that one.
The problem is she needs something to plagiarize.
That's true.
Plagiarize.
Well,
you'd actually have to write it.
Dixie, if you get Dixie in there, that'd be plagiarizing that, although that's probably not copywritten. The new motion here doesn't name a hidden document or anything. It doesn't name a one lying witness. It demands prosecutors search 10 categories, witness deals, discipline files, lab records, and then swear in writing that nothing helpful to Murdaugh exists beyond what they have handed over. Dick Harpootlian filed it knowing that he can't really point to a single specific thing, but there's been some issues with SLED. There's been some SLED agents that have lost their jobs since the last trial for covering some things up, not necessarily connected to Murdaugh, but other cases and such, which will, I'm sure, be brought into this trial. They're going and asking, is SLED hiding something, you know, or is Harpootlian just fishing? Do you think there's anything there that might come to light? And what are the odds of Alec getting anything when you're asking SLED to investigate SLED and basically come up with anything that they didn't show the first round?
Well, first of all, I do think two things can be true at once. In other words, yes, it's a fishing expedition. But secondarily, this is all stuff that has to be provided anyway. You can't hide Brady Giglio information. If you got a bad cop, a cop who has done something against the rules, that their personnel file, if they are involved in this case, not just any miscellaneous sled person, but if they were involved in this case, that has to be coughed up anyway. So to me, he's not asking for anything, you know, the lab work, all that. He's not asking for anything unusual or out of the ordinary. He's just putting it on record and he wants it said. There's nothing. And you know what that always makes me think with him is maybe he knows a little something and he wants to make sure that he gets it. And if he doesn't, he's going to, you know, play the, oh, wait a minute, I asked for this and you didn't give it and see, it's right here. I wouldn't doubt that at all with him.
But wait, there's more. Yeah. I mean, and it's not like they're going into this. I mean, as much, again, I'm not trying to be sympathetic to Alec Murdaugh. I think he's a horrible human being. But I don't know. There's points here to be argued. David Owen ran the Murdaugh investigation. Last year, a judge threw out the murder indictment against Michael Colucci, another case connected to Owen, after finding evidence that could have helped Colucci was never properly turned over, which is exactly what the defense of Alec Murdaugh is asking for and saying, you didn't cross the T's and dot the I's over there. Did you do it over on our side? Now the same agency is being told to go search its own Murdaugh files and report what it finds. So who's in charge of that, Jen? Who's going to go through? Is it Colucci that's going to have to go through and go, oh yeah, shoot, I missed this? Or is an independent body going through to look for the Brady Giglio information? How do they make sure that the information goes where it needs to appropriately go?
Well, I could only tell you how it does in the Bureau.
Yeah.
If something like this comes up, you'll have a couple of, and it's the worst to get called on these teams. I've been on taint teams. Those also suck. Where basically it's like, okay, Jen, you need to look through and see if there's anything that was missed. Mm-hmm. And so you and maybe another person is literally going to go through the file and make sure they have everything that would be possibly exculpatory. The difference between, I think, the Bureau and a lot of these other agencies, when I was in, it was an open book. In other words, huge war room, and we just invited every defense attorney, come in and look. It's all right here for you. Mm-hmm. I know now, working on the expert witness side, I see they're doing a lot with just putting everything on thumb drives and sending it all out like they did in Idaho. Here's all these terabytes. Good luck. But that's the way to do it, is just you give them everything. Don't sift and sort through and say, oh, this is too much inside information on how we operate. And this is this. And just give it to them. That's the safe thing to do. And the Bureau does that. If SLED didn't do that, or because of this request, I think you're going to see a couple of SLED agents going through this and double checking that they have everything.
Yeah, I mean, cross the T's, dot the I's, because impropriety is what the defense of Murdaugh is going to be going after here. If they can't get all the way to a true third party culprit and point a finger at somebody, that's going to be something Karen Reed-ish, where it's like, can't really say for sure it was this, but we're going to allude to this. And reasonable doubt is a powerful thing. And that's really what they're going after. One of the big pieces of evidence that's being talked about here on the Murdaugh side is the white shirt that Alec was wearing the night that they were dead. The white shirt Murdaugh wore that night was supposed to carry the blood spatter that tied him to the killing. SLED zone testing came back negative for human blood. And then a chemical applied during testing left the shirt unusable forever. No retest, no second lab ever. The defense calls it suppression. The state would call that chemical a standard step. Do you buy that the shirt was ruined by accident? Their own two agencies disagreed, and now no one else can check the shirt that they claim, you know, may have something on. One test says no, then another test said, no, there is something here. And okay, well, let's double check it from the defense, because your first first one said no. Your second one says yes. But now no one can confirm either way. It's convoluted. It's confusing. It seems a little shady, even if it's not. And I'm sure it'll be brought up in that sort of light. What do you think the shirt does for Alec Murdaugh in trial two, if anything?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, this happens all the time with DNA. You only get so many chances at this microscopic piece of DNA, and then it's adulterated and nobody else can test it afterwards. So, you know, issues, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the same with this situation in a sense, that what was used to be able to extract the blood proteins on that shirt adulterated then the shirt for further testing, just like you pointed out. Sorry to repeat. So that is absolutely a question for the jury. The jury's going to hear both sides of it. They're going to hear exactly what happened. And then the jurors are going to have to make that determination. But that's part of the process, the chemical process. You're going to have a lab technician go, listen, I do this all the time. And unfortunately, it destroys what I'm doing, but that doesn't change my results. It doesn't show my results aren't good. And then they're either going to believe the lab tech or they're not.
Well, and which one do they believe? The one, the first test that says nothing, or the second one that says magically now there might be something here? I mean,
some tests are better than others, Tony.
Sure. It's just, what do you, it's not the strongest piece of evidence in the world at all for a case like this. And when there's so much question, it just adds another piece of doubt to the pile, it seems. We'll see where it goes. Obviously, there's many a months away before this starts, but it's going to be one of those that before you know it, it's going to be here. I mean, we're almost towards the end of this year now, so it's starting up early next. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on Alec Murdaugh and where that is all going. One more case to get to before we wrap up today, and that would be the trial of Lindsey Clancy. It is still going on, second week, wrapping up and coming to a close. It's changed the shape of the case. Clancy spoke in open court for the first time, signed away the state's burden on the forensics basis, and those basics, which have already been pretty much agreed to, that yes, she killed the children. We don't need to reiterate this 50 ways to Tuesday. And her lawyer confirmed what's been true from the start. She doesn't dispute that she killed Cora Dawson and Callan. The only question this jury is deciding is whether her mind was her own that night. Retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer is with us to break this down. It's been interesting watching the arguments here. On August 4th, Reddington stipulated to the forensics, the blood, the DNA, the exercise ban, told the court it spares the jury dozens of witnesses. Look at what actually landed here. The jury loses now days of sitting with the physical horror of what happened in that basement. That's meaningful. That's powerful stuff if you're trying to put Lindsey Clancy behind bars, but it also, nobody's arguing it either, but the prosecution also just got a bit shorter as well. Cleaner sprint to the end of this. Who does this help? Does it help Lindsey Clancy? Does it help the prosecution not continue to hammer this over and over, something she's already admitted doing? I guess it all depends where the minds of the jurors are at, but what do you think?
Oh, it helps Lindsey Clancy. It's a terrible stipulation for them. I mean, not for them, for the prosecution. And this is why. You want those jurors to understand exactly what happened to those children. That one actually held on afterwards to life. I've tried to explain. It's pretty easy to make somebody lose unconsciousness with a stranglehold. It is very difficult to actually murder them. In other words, to have the oxygen be depleted from their brain for long enough that they actually die. This is not a quick process. It's not a few seconds. This is a long process. And I was really disappointed. I knew that there'd be no cross or anything, but the ME, you know, was great and to the point and believable, but there should have been more details. I know they at least get the autopsy photos, but it's such a win for the defense not to have those jurors really understand the breadth of this murderous act committed by Lindsey Clancy.
Didn't the exercise bans do most of the work for Lindsey, though? I mean, I'm not trying to be cold and callous here, just arguing the points of the case of, you know, yes, exactly what you said. It would take a lot of work. I've never done that, never put my arm, my hands around someone's neck, but I'll take your word for it that it's not an easy thing to do. She didn't do it. The exercise band, she put them around them, and then the exercise bands pretty much went to town and finished the job. So they wouldn't necessarily be sitting there going, and then she took her cold, dead hands and squeezed their... I mean, that wouldn't be the argument. It's exercise bands. She's out the window. So I don't know. I mean, I also do wonder, is there a level of churn, if you will, that's going on with this jury? Not that you can churn the jurors out, but just burnout. Maybe burnout's the right word. Burnout with the jurors of hearing about what happened and the state hammering it over and over when we already know what happened. She's already admitted to doing it. She's sitting there crying and sobbing in court every day through all of this. I don't know. If I'm a juror and I'm sitting there, I'd be like, what are we doing? This is already established.
It's established in a very scholastic way, not in an emotional way, not in something that I think you can really picture. And I know what you're saying about the bands. I say instead of a wedding next year, we do a self-defense class for the team.
Hey.
And I show you all that even with a ligature, a band, a belt, a rope, whatever you have, there's still a lot of work to be done. And we saw it.
Yeah.
I think it was Callan lived through it. Not Dawson. I pretty much think it was Callan, if I recall right from the testimony, that lived through it. Because as hard as she tried and as tight as those bands were, it didn't work. And that poor kid had to suffer, you know, long after. So I guess my point is that, you know, it is what it is. That's what they decided. You're right. It might have meant jury fatigue. I'm just saying the defense had a huge coup with that and the prosecutor didn't.
I want to talk about the pills because they keep that was a big point this week that the prosecution thought it was making. I thought it kind of landed somewhat empty. If you understand how these things work, she was only on so many pills and they weren't to a toxic level. Nobody's arguing that she was like taking these things to a toxic level. The argument has always been the interactions of these pills being on and off these antipsychotics, these SSRIs, the various types of drugs that she was prescribed by the doctors, and there was no other things in there. She wasn't recreationally taking anything. Were not working. They were and they do work against each other. And it's not a one size fits all. If one person is taking this version of the cocktail and person B is taking this version of the cocktail, both can have extremely different psychiatric reactions to them. That's just fact. But it feels like Massachusetts is saying one size fits all. Because she didn't take him to a toxic level, she couldn't possibly have been in a frame of psychosis. On top of that, we're not even arguing that the pills necessarily were the cause of the psychosis. She already had that underlying condition. The pills were supposed to try and help get her out of that. So take the pills out of the equation. I don't care if she took one pill or none. She was in the state mentally through her own biology that would have put her into that sort of state. So how powerful are these pill arguments that the state is making with the jury?
Well, I think that they're just trying to get that off of the table as far as the jurors considering that that really constituted why she did this. And I thought they hit some home. In other words, when you show the pill, you and I had talked about this actually. Mm-hmm. You can be prescribed drugs all day long. The question is, are you taking them? Look at all these people who go to get help and then they get it and then it sits there and they don't take them, right? And they tried to show all that, but it was definitely in her system to some degree.
Yeah.
I think they're just trying to say this. It was put out there, oh my gosh, 13 medications. She was on all these drugs And then you kind of looked at, well, wait a minute. She wasn't really taking all of it. She was taking some of it. Well, and so I think they diluted the point.
Which if, and what I'm even more horrified is not that she wasn't taking 13 medications. It's the fact that she was prescribed 13 medications that are very powerful drugs, mental psychiatric drugs that can very, very much do horrible things to your brain or totally mess you up in that short of a period of time. Not that taking them all together is the answer. It's that getting on them, getting off them, getting on them, getting off them, taking some of this, taking a little bit more of that, taking a little less of this one. And that balance, that certainly can lead to psychosis. That is like, that's how that happens. That's the recipe for that sort of thing to take place. That's why it is so important that these things are managed correctly and effectively and not just quick little 17-minute visits. Gee, you feeling nifty today or you not? It's horrifying how some of these things are managed. And it's not just Lindsay Clan. This is how it works throughout. I've been in many a doctor's offices for the med checks, and it's like, in and out. It's a cattle call. And they're only as good as you are communicating with your doctor. I will definitely give it that. But at the same point, you're also asking someone who many doctors have said suffering from bipolar, suffering from psychosis. Those aren't going to be the most reputable individuals, unfortunately, to give a accurate statement about their mental health to the doctor that's trying to help them. So naturally, they're already at a disadvantage because of their own biological makeup and what they're trying to communicate to the doctor that's trying to help them. It's a shit show. Any way you look at it. But it feels like the state's trying to ask people not to understand how these sort of things work or by omission, not help them understand how things work. It's feeling more like a carny trick than it is a prosecution.
Well, I want to say this. First of all, there's a lot of blame to go around in this deal.
Yeah.
I still blame the husband. I blame the medical people. But number one, I blame Lindsay Clancy. She's a medical professional. This wasn't her first rodeo, understanding meds. She gets it. She clearly knew she was having issues. He knew she was having issues. I mean, that testimony where, yeah, she said she wanted to kill her kids. I mean, let's just start with that. Maybe that's at the point that you say, kids, we're going to stay at grandma's for a while. Sure. We need to get mommy healthy, and mommy needs to check herself into an outpatient. At what point?
She didn't. She got kicked out.
Well, longer. She needs to go back in. She needs to do whatever. I cannot exonerate her from culpability if at the moment she is strangling her kids one after another, if she knows right from wrong. That's the only legal point we need. All this other crap is crap in my mind. Is she on medication? How much was it? Blah, blah, was she feeling bad? Was she depressed? Okay, forget it. What did she know at the time? And I would contend, and no matter which one you believe, whether it's the prosecution, she lowered herself down, or the defense, she full on meant to kill herself. By the way, she cut herself the wrong way, and she's a nurse, so I'm not buying that. But I do believe she meant to throw herself out and just maybe die or hurt herself in this way, but it's because she knew what she did was wrong. Either she wanted to die and not have to face justice like all these other. I mean, what if we were talking about a guy here? Look at these guys that kill Travis Decker, that suffocate their little girls and leave them in the woods.
Yeah.
He was suffering from a PTSD, military guy. He offed his kids. Nobody cares about him. Nobody feels sorry for him.
But you also see a lot of pre-planning in a lot of these sort of things. You also see motivation in a lot of these sort of cases. And I admit, there's plenty of cases where people argue the insanity defense, and they're not. They were just shitty human beings who are pre-planning their getaway, their new life, and getting rid of the obstacles, the people in it, as they viewed them to get there. There's zero of that here. All there is evidence of her being a loving mother, asking for help, getting help, trying to get help. on this med, off that med. I can't think of a case where I've seen someone be more vocal and more opportunistic at trying to beg for help than this case. There's been so many where they got the girlfriend or the boyfriend or the new life plan or there's evidence of there's another side here they're trying to get to. Her side she was trying to get to was sanity, and she didn't get there. I don't see any. I mean, if strangling your children with exercise bands when you have nothing but a track record of being an attentive, loving, caring parent through all of their existence up until that point and begging for help, I don't know what the definition of psychosis is, if that's not it. I mean, that is psychosis.
There's a little bit of testimony, and you know, that came in, like the grandfather is an example.
Yeah.
That I see a lot of frustration with her. And
sure.
That's what you see, right? Like grabbing the kids, Dawson's out of control, Dawson's being difficult. He even describes, he's like, well, he's pretty difficult. I mean, he's a good kid, right? The grandfather was so guarded at his truth, but he kept letting it slip out, even with her. Oh, she was really nice, even though she lost it. You know, it's so interesting to watch his testimony, because I think the truth with him is she was on the edge, and I don't think she gently grabbed those arms. I think she was pissed and pulled. I think there are so many things that went on behind closed doors with somewhat violent toward those kids and just being on the edge.
But there's no evidence of that. There's nobody that's testified to any of that.
There's that piece of evidence.
That's like it's minor frustration with having three children under the age of five. Show me one mother with three children under the age of five who isn't having shitty days, some days isn't frustrated to the moon about that. I mean, that's life. And there's certainly horrible ones that act out and do horrible, horrible things towards their children for those minor frustrations. The path that I see when they're talking about that doesn't really deviate from 99% of mothers or parents out there with that many children under their care at those sort of ages. It's frustrating. It's hard. It's difficult. It's exhausting. You're tired. And then if you have other underlying medical conditions going on, that makes it even worse. I just don't see anything outside of the norm when we're talking about that with her that would have been a red flag going, shit, she's probably going to go put exercise bands around.
Okay, you ready? Here's the 99% outside the norm. Bam. That is, she totally crossed the line. I've always said this, and you agree, I think, by her, you know, trying to go for help. She was losing it. She didn't like those kids. She was frustrated with them. She wanted to kill them. She said that. She told the husband that. So this wasn't something that just happened. This was something that she had one. And I know, okay, I called it postpartum. Everybody says, no, really, she was just physically, you know, whatever, cut from stem to stern. And it was difficult to get better and all of that. And then the second one was true postpartum. And then this one was postpartum that led to psychosis. At what point do you say, I'm not going to have any kids because I'm a medical professional and I know I'm going crazy. And so
I agree, but that still doesn't show that she was in her right mind.
Then why did she jump?
Because she was in a psychotic state.
No, because I would argue it was because of her self-preservation, whether you want to take the state side that she wanted to sort of commit suicide so people would feel sorry for her right now, like people are doing in a courtroom, or she really wanted to kill herself so she wouldn't have to face the ramifications of being sentenced to a prison sentence. So either way, I see somebody, this is called consciousness of guilt. People who are nuts, remember the guy that killed all his kids, these little boys, and then he sat on the front stoop?
Yeah, yeah.
And he called and he said, I just killed all my kids. That guy was crazy. And he, you know, they found him nuts. those people don't think they did anything. Well, they know they're not able to control themselves, and they have an argument. This one showed consciousness of guilt. This one showed planning by doing it when he was gone. I think this, she knew right from wrong at that moment. That's what I think. And I know it's so unpopular, but I really do think that.
But is the best place for someone like this, who's in this sort of mental state at the end of the day, I know we disagree on this, but even with the disagreement on that, is the right place for her a prison, or is the right place for her a mental hospital for the rest of her existence, which is pretty much what she wants?
I wouldn't give her what she wants. I think she needs psychiatric care within a prison.
They don't offer that, though, the way that it's kind of needed. You know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, that's kind of what it is. It's not like she's, you know, it would be psychiatric care in a confined setting. It's not like she can just, you know, check out on a Tuesday.
I mean, you know, an interesting parallel case, right, is Yates.
Yeah.
That drowned her five children in Houston.
Yeah.
And she still is in a mental institution and she doesn't want out.
Yeah.
Your point. Every year they offer her the opportunity to take a competency test to see if she can be released. And every year she denies it. I just read her last denial of it in January of this year. She doesn't want out. But I'm just saying, do you get any punishment for wiping out three young lives? Is that punishable?
I don't know that there is a punishment that is in existence that would punish it adequately other than death. If someone did it intentionally, I think the punishment is still being alive, quite honestly. I would be, if I were a betting person, I said this earlier today, I would venture to guess that Lindsay Clancy's probably not going to be around within 5 years. I don't know how she doesn't self-exit herself off this mortal coil at some point, living with what the realization of what took place, whether or not she was conscious or understanding what she was doing, but knowing this is the reality, there's no coming back from this. And she knows it. Everyone knows it. I think she probably wants to die to this day. I think her attorney even said that. I don't know. This case has really gotten me on not. It just seems it hasn't done anything to help people better understand postpartum or women's mental health. And I know they say it's not about that. It's 1,000% about that. It just kind of, it feels like it's Massachusetts. It's a witch trial and they want to burn the witch because we're going to pretend that mental health isn't a thing. But I don't know. I'm glad we disagreed. We got a little spicy, Jen, and a little show and tell there today with some props, which is always exciting.
Sorry.
And your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you guys to weigh in and give us your thoughts in the comment section right there. That's going to wrap it up. Until next time, for Jen, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.